Welcome to Friday. It's KOW Seattle time for the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. You can join us on Twitter. Hop on right now at KOW. This is the hour we spend together and figure out what happened this week and what it means. And we're happy that we've got Natalie Brand here, political reporter, King 5. Good to see you again, Natalie.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
University of Washington political science professor Chris Parker. You go by Christopher or Chris on the air?
Christopher is fine.
How about Professor?
See, then you get me mixed up with Gilligan's Island.
I'm like, oh, the professor. Yeah, that happens to you a lot, does it?
Sometimes.
And Bill Bryant, the former Port of Seattle commissioner, former Republican candidate for governor, now running for Congress as of this week?
Yeah, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. That is suddenly an open question because we have an open seat. We got to start with our top story, which is that Amazon wants to see other cities. Yesterday, the company, out of the blue, asked North American cities besides Seattle to make them an offer, make a bid for Amazon to open a second headquarters in your city, bringing up to 50,000 jobs, not warehouse jobs, well-paid headquarters jobs. This would be a co-headquarters, says Amazon, a, quote, full equal to their Seattle HQ. Bill, put your headphones on so you can hear this, because I asked GeekWire's Todd Bishop, why would Amazon want to split its headquarters?
This gives them a bit of a hedge. They can have a base in another city, perhaps in another country.
A hedge against what?
A hedge against immigration policies, against growth constraints, against all the things that could keep them from expanding in the way that they might want to expand and attracting the kind of talent they want to attract.
For example, Canada is more welcoming of immigrants, maybe more lenient about drone regulation. And even if it's an American city, Amazon spreads its risk and its influence. They could play cities off each other. And apparently not everybody wants to come to Seattle. I also asked Todd, is the Seattle boom coming to an end?
It's certainly a sign that it's not going to be what it could have been, for better and for worse.
Yeah.
This is not, in my mind, on the same level of Boeing actually shifting its headquarters to Chicago in 2001. A lot of us were around here for that. That was a complete bombshell. I think that this is a big surprise, and I do agree with the phrase wake-up call. And it's something that I think should cause people in leadership positions in this community to sit back and take stock of exactly what's being done to ensure a robust economy.
My Week in Review panel, I want to know what you all think, because the response has been a Rorschach test for the Amazon-Seattle relationship. Councilmember Shama Sawant told the Seattle Times Amazon's announcement is reminiscent of Boeing's ongoing efforts to ship jobs out of the Seattle area and hold us hostage. Councilmember Lisa Herbold said it gives us a little breathing room to build good mass transit, ensure affordable housing, and open up pathways into higher education. The Chamber of Commerce said this should come as no surprise as the cities continue to implement policies that create an environment that it's at best unfriendly and at worst outright hostile toward the needs of our largest employers. Wow. It really is amazing to have this debate kindled. What's your reaction?
I think it's really too early. Everyone would agree. It's too early to know the actual impact until we know which other city we're talking about and what ends up happening in future years. However, I mean, the unique angle here is second and equal headquarters. What does that mean moving forward? Could people who were established in Seattle end up moving to that second headquarters? As you were reading some of the very strong statements, this is now going to continue to be a political issue and create questions and debate over city policies and what's working, what may not be working.
Yeah. So, Bill, where do you stand on the Amazon's holding us hostage versus we are too unfriendly to business?
Continue? I'll tell you, I run a business in this city, and I don't think that if I were setting up my company today, I know that if I were setting up my company today as opposed to 25 years ago, I would not start it in Seattle. There's outright hostility towards the business community on the part of a lot of the city council.
What's an example of that?
Well, look at Sawant's statements where she's actually talking about we need to actually nationalize Boeing and Amazon and some of the largest corporations.
And is that an active threat to businesses?
It's an active threat when no one on the city council or the mayor steps up and condemns her for making such irresponsible comments. It makes it clear to the business community that that kind of comment is a legitimate part of our political conversation. The other problem we have is we have a city council, which is a regulatory factory. I mean, they are sitting around thinking about new regulations. A business can accommodate regulations, but it's got to have certainty. I'm trying to make some decisions right now on where we're going to expand in 36 to 48 months, whether it's going to be at our Seattle office or our Sacramento office or somewhere else.
Well, why don't you hold a lottery and have all American and North American cities?
Well, what I'm saying is I need to know what the regulatory environment's going to be in 36 months here in Seattle. Does anybody have any idea what new regulations they'll come up with between now and 36 months from now? No.
Life changes fast in a city council. You've got other responsibilities.
I think you have a city council which is not conducive to expanding business in Seattle. And I'm not going to suggest that Amazon's setting up a second headquarters solely because of that. But if we don't take into account the environment we're creating here in Seattle, I don't think Amazon's going to be the last one to make an announcement like this.
And this does give Amazon some leverage, a position of power when they are entering into future negotiations with the city. But while a lot of people are sounding these alarm bells, I would also note there's been a number of folks who say if Amazon were to bring tens of thousands of more jobs to the city, where would those people go? Mm-hmm. Have we hit a growth limit to some extent?
So let me just chime in just for a second. So we're talking about Seattle right now, which is apropos because clearly we are in Seattle right now. But what about some of the larger implications of where Amazon could set up another shop? And so I was just reading something in the New York Times in which they were talking about, you know, the transfer. They had like 20 top cities to which they thought, you know, Amazon might be a good fit. And most of which were in the South, right? Or on the Southeast Coast. And the idea that, which I would have never thought about, well, given me enough time, I would have thought about it. But the whole idea is that moving this Amazon, you know, which has, for the most part, progressive values, right? For the most part, right? Progressive values. Moving and having 50,000 people move to Raleigh, North Carolina, which is already the Research Triangle, which is already fairly progressive, or Dallas or Atlanta. I think that could be a really, really, really good thing.
How does Amazon have progressive values? What do you mean?
Well, progressive in a sense that the people that work at Amazon are necessarily progressive because they are really well educated. And so education leads towards, it's conducive towards small d democracy, like, you know, this belief in rights, progressive values and stuff like that, right? I'm not talking about Amazon's corporate culture per se. I'm talking about the people that will work at Amazon have progressive values.
So you'd like to see the higher educated, a lot of immigrants, a more forward-leaning attitude in the Southeast?
Yes. In the deep South, you know, you got five deep Southern states, which I don't think Amazon would ever go to one of those, which would be South Carolina, Alabama, Louisiana.
Are those right-to-work states?
50. Yeah. Those are right-to-work states. All of those are right-to-work states. But I'm just saying that I didn't see any of those states mentioned. I would be good to have a place like Amazon in one of those states, but I can't think of, you know, I don't really want to go here, but one of the criteria is a strong research university. I think most of those, South Carolina is another one. None of those states really have a strong research university from which to attract talent. And so call me an intellectual snob, but there it is.
Seems like, too, I mean, this competition angle is interesting. Amazon probably has a good idea of where it's looking to go. But to put out this message to cities to send me your best deal, it's going to be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, isn't that all about tax breaks and no income tax and, right? That it sounds just like leverage, like playing one off another. Pittsburgh's mayor says, he's, quote, on it. Mayor of Memphis, quote, absolutely make a bid. Philadelphia's mayor says his city would be a prime location for Amazon.
Huh?
Prime, get it? Good one, Philly. Chicago's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, reportedly has spoken personally with Bezos already. Tulsa's mayor says he'll do, quote, here's the key phrase, he'll do whatever it takes. So what do you think in Seattle, how do you think we respond? Because we've got the chamber saying we need more business-friendly policies. Bill Bryant, you know, saying the same. You've got, as we said, you've got people saying, thank goodness, let's take a pause. We're crowded enough. We're expensive enough. What do you? So, and the mayor, Mayor Murray, came out and said, It's time for we've got to have a conversation about what Amazon needs. So what do you think actually happens because of this bidding announcement?
And do we have another task force now?
Oh, yeah. Well,
definitely
another blue ribbon commission on how we can keep business in Seattle. I think what we need to do is take this very seriously. I don't think it's time to hit alarm bells, but we need to recognize that we've created an environment that some businesses don't feel comfortable operating in. And we need to deal with the basics in this city. If we want to keep business here, let's have regulatory certainty. Let's not have a program where new regulations are being introduced every other day or at least every other month. And so we have no idea what the regulatory environment's going to look like in 36 to 48 months. Let's fix our traffic problems. If you can't get your workers to the office and home in a reasonable period of time, you're going to move to a city that can. Let's deal with our homeless problem and the fact that we have opioid addictions which are spilling out onto the streets. The other day I walked out of my office, which is right downtown, right in front of our building on the sidewalk, there's a guy tapping his veins and shooting up with something. No one's doing anything. That's not good when you're trying to also promote yourself as a city that wants tourism during the summer
but
months.
This is what, Bill, this is what I mean by a Rorschach test, because aren't you just advocating all the things you want anyway and kind of—
No, I'm saying this is what a healthy city looks like.
Yes.
And when you have a city council that's running around talking about nationalizing private companies as opposed to figuring out how we can get traffic moving and how we can get people the health and care they need to get off the streets— then you're going to have businesses saying, well, you know what? I'm going to move to a city that does have its act together.
But isn't it more likely that a zillion-dollar company wants to just not have all its eggs in one basket for regulatory reasons? I had someone email me and say, what about an earthquake that would, you know, bring down? Amazon can't afford to have a massive earthquake. I mean, they've got so many things to think about at their scale. It's political. It's economic. It's leveraging. It's going
a smart business move, and right. It's beyond just the city of Seattle.
Mm-hmm. But I agree with that, and I think it's a smart business move, and they need to diversify their geography. Yep. All that's true.
Okay.
But let's not use that as an excuse. Let's realize that there are other issues at play here, and we should address them before other companies begin to decide to set up, what is it, a second co-equal headquarters, which is an oxymoron in and of itself.
And it's kind of scary if you think, well, if it's really a co-equal headquarters, why should Amazon be here instead of there? Obviously, they've got tons of investment in South Lake Union. They took over South Lake Union and Denny Triangle. They have biospheres here, for God's sake. They're still filling thousands of positions in Seattle right now. Mm-hmm. But so most people I'm hearing on this are saying, even if they were to move away or pull away somewhat, that would be far away. Don't worry if you just bought an expensive home in King County. But what writing is on the wall? These discussions are starting now.
And it's starting an interesting conversation at an interesting time, just ahead of a mayoral race.
Yes, in fact.
A quick question. Election. Do we have any models of this happening before? Okay, the whole Boeing thing, but you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. that was a matter of degree and not that was a matter of kind and not degree when it comes to sort of modeling this. Is there any other model on which we can draw that would predict the future of what kind of impact this would have on Seattle?
I don't know if that's the case, because my colleague Heather Graff talked to a professor at Foster School of Business yesterday who said this is not a usual move. Then again, Amazon is not a usual company. They're known for thinking out of the box and doing different things that, you know.
Yeah, it's all new, and we'll follow it with you. We on the Week in Review are covering the top stories of the week. The only member of Congress from Puget Sound area, only Republican member of Congress, retiring from Congress suddenly, and we've got a Seahawks star saying he had a run-in with police exactly of the kind that he is protesting when he sits during the national anthem, and lots more to cover on The Week in Review with Natalie Brand and Christopher Parker and Bill Bryant. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Central Co-op, a community-owned grocery store. Central Co-op supports farmers and other suppliers in the Pacific Northwest, bringing new, fresh, and seasonal products to the community, open to everyone 7 days a week. More information at centralcoop.coop.
Hey, good afternoon. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. KUOW's Week in Review continues momentarily. First, let me tell you that it's 70 degrees in Seattle under an overcast sky. A slight chance of showers is in the forecast today, We should reach a high of 71. Tomorrow, still a chance of showers, but much cooler. Saturday's high, 63.
Support for KUOW comes from BECU, host of the People Helping People Awards, which donates to local nonprofits nominated by members. Every debit purchase, BECU donates to the goal of $500,000 this year. Learn more about how to help at becu.org/makeadifference. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, right back to the Week in Review on KUOW. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. Amazon was the economic bombshell. The political surprise this week was Congressman Dave Reichert saying he's done. The only Republican in Congress from the Puget Sound area will not run for re-election, and he didn't say why. Who knows why?
I take him at his word when you read the statement that he was looking
spending time with his family?
Yeah, actually, I really do. He's had a very distinguished career at the county level as sheriff and then in Congress. He's looking at what would be a hard campaign. I think he'll win it if you were to run, but it would be a hard campaign.
Why so hard? By the way, this is Bill Bryant, who's run some campaigns yourself, ran for
just
governor.
Just hard because you've got a number of Democrats already lining up, and some people at the national level in the Democratic Party have said that's a race that they might look at targeting. And so he'd have to work hard. He'd win, but he'd have to work hard. And you have to ask yourself, do I want to work that hard just to serve two or four more years?
It was going to be a competitive race.
Yeah, definitely.
He had a target on his back by the DCCC from the beginning. But I think he had to look at a bunch of different factors. In an interview with me this week, I asked, is it the current political climate to some extent? And he said that would be part of the equation. I wouldn't say a major part, but it was definitely a part of it.
I want to know what political science professor Christopher Parker thinks about. This will be talked about as a referendum on Trump. Do you think that's really how voters look at it here?
I think yes. So I think in this polarized political climate in which we currently find ourselves, I mean, it's hard to tell which way is up right now. And I do think, you know, the way Trump has been running things, and just I want you to note, I refuse to call that man president. He's number 45 or Trump as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Yeah, this would definitely be a referendum on Trump. The issue is whether or not the resist movement, if you will, really has legs, and whether or not this anger, you know, that the left currently has can sustain itself, and whether or not that will bleed over into the current campaign. I think it's a possibility the D's could possibly take it, but it's just really hard to say right now because, I mean, this guy he was an incumbent for how many years? What, 7 terms?
Yeah, 14 years.
Yeah, 14 years. And so, and I would suspect that since he seems by all indications, or rather moderate by today's standards, that a moderate could possibly win, you know, from the R's, but I think a more moderate Dem would have to run, and that's not where the resistance is going right now.
And then to that point, Professor Parker, I think it depends which part of the district really turns out.
This is a weird district.
It's a very weird district.
And technically, if you look at following redistricting, it does favor Republicans slightly because it moved east in over the Cascades.
For those who don't know, this is the 8th Congressional District, East King and Pierce counties, but now over the Cascades into the Wenatchee area.
And that's why, you know, I asked
Ellensburg.
I asked Congressman Reichert, which way does he think his district goes? Does it finally flip? And in his words, he said, well, before this announcement, pundits were saying that it's Congressman Reichert's district and he had probably the edge. But after this announcement, pundits have been saying it leans to a Democrat. And he said he thinks that could be true in his conversations with different people in his district. But like you said, it depends on turnout.
And it depends on what
candidates.
It depends on what policies and narrative that Democrat presents. And I disagree. I don't think, I think the Democrats would like to make this case or this race a referendum on the president. I think at the end of the day, being against President Trump is not going to be enough. And while nationally, people like to say that this race is a referendum on something national, I think when people actually have to go fill out that ballot, they're going to vote for the congressman or the candidate for Congress who they like more and who think represents their values. Well, it might try to be a nationalized race. At the end of the day, I think you're going to have a candidate who can speak to the people of the 8th, and that means speaking to suburban voters in Sammamish and rural voters in Pierce County and eastern Washington voters in Ellensburg and in Wenatchee. And that's a complicated narrative, and we're going to have a Democrat who can pull that together if they think they're going to take this seat.
Can I comment on that?
Please.
So I do believe
you are a political science professor.
So I do believe that we're going to have a Democrat that's running, you know, that's going to be, you know, a little more moderate, like you said, that speaks to these voters. But to say this is not a referendum on Trump, I just can't go there with you because there's too much evidence that suggests otherwise.
What is that evidence?
I mean, so thank you, because you just led into a plug for my new book.
Oh.
So my colleague, Matt Barreto, who's now at UCLA, and I are working on a book called The Great White Hope, Donald Trump, Race, and the Crisis of American Democracy. And what we show is that people who are hardcore Trump supporters, not even hardcore Trump supporters, but just Trump supporters in general, they are driven by this sense of existential threat, right? Trump sort of represents a symbol for them, sort of fighting back this rising tide, you know, of progressivism, and just let's just call this what it is, this sort of this concern with demographic change, right? And people on the left, what we show is that people of color who saw Trump as an existential threat tended to turn out more, like they were 64% more likely to turn out than folks of color who didn't see Trump as an existential threat. On both sides, this election was about a sense of existential threat. And so,
I know that plays out in a presidential election. Does that play out, though, when you're talking about one member of one district in a big Congress?
So
you're electing your local person.
We have to realize, so maybe not during a midterm election, right? So I'll grant you that. During a presidential election cycle, it's the presidential election really, really seeps into everything else.
That's true. But in an off year, when you have an open seat, I'm not sure that I think that the Democrats are going to want to nationalize the race and make this all about President Trump, but I don't know that you're going to be successful in doing that. And to say that this is definitely a referendum on Trump is to suggest that all of the special elections we've had over the last year were referendums on the president. And if that's the case,
now, he won those, but look where he won those.
I think it also depends on the national issues that are top of mind next year. I mean, we've been talking about health care and immigration. What is on voters' minds? Which candidate is speaking to them? I mean, on the Democratic side, there are already 8 candidates who have announced. One is a pediatrician from Issaquah entering the race because right at around the time when healthcare was in the spotlight, right? We have a former Democrat. We have a former prosecutor. So who breaks through and is the right person at the right time for a number of issues?
How about Republican? What Republican runs?
It sounds like, I mean, all the rumors and indicators would point
Bill Bryan,
you know, Rossi, who has wanted to run in this district for a long time. Uh-huh. I think that there's a move by the state Republican Party to try to coalesce around one Republican candidate, especially when you have a long list of Democratic, you know, candidates who were going to challenge Reichert. So they want a known quantity who can come in with name, ID, and kind of fundraise in a hurry and coalesce that vote.
Name ID, Bill Bryant?
Ask.
Someone who's been on both sides of the mountains?
As has been reported, there's a rumor. I was actually in Walla Walla the last few days because I was supposed to be today on day 3 of a bike trip that got canceled because of all the smoke all over the state.
Oh.
And so I was over there with some friends talking about whether or not we were going to pull the plug on the trip when this announcement was made, and suddenly my phone began to ring. And I received 55-56% of that congressional district last year. So any Republican who gets 55-56% of the district a year before is going to get called.
You have already won that district.
But I do think that a lot of folks are looking to see what Dino Rossi does, and I am not looking for something to run for right now. I was hoping to be on a bike trip, and I'm looking to plan the next bike trip, not jumping into a campaign.
That's the politician aw shucks thing, isn't it?
No, not really.
That's a pretty honest answer. I've had a really fun summer.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of hiking and camping and a lot of biking, and I'm enjoying that right now.
I guess my question moving forward is, does a bigger name on the Democratic side or a known name, right, jump in to challenge someone who's already run statewide multiple times? How do you, having just run a campaign last year, how do you think Rossi would do in that district?
Well, he lives in the district, and he has been serving that district in the legislature on special terms this last year, and was very instrumental in helping move serious pieces of legislation through the legislature. And as a result, he's introduced himself to voters who might not have remembered him when he ran previously and who have moved into the district in the last few years. So I think if you're looking at a Republican who could win that seat, Dino is somebody who has the name recognition, who could generate the dollars quickly needed to put together a solid campaign.
But facing a more blue Eastern King County, the indivisible movement that we've seen demonstrating.
Well, as I said, I carried that district by 55-56%, and I'm sure that Dino could carry it by even more.
All right, well, Dave Reichert is going to have to deal with DACA before he leaves. Mm-hmm. He's got 6 months to deal with that, but he's out at the end of his term next year. We're going to talk about the Trump administration's rescinding or phasing out DACA and why and what that's really about. And we're going to talk about Michael Bennett's unusual couple of weeks and what really might have happened in Las Vegas and about the fires that caused the cancellation of Bill Bryant's bicycle trip and more on the Week in Review. It's KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Natalie Brand, political reporter at King 5, Christopher Parker, University of Washington political science professor, Bill Bryant, founder and chair of Bryant Christie Incorporated, International Trade Negotiations.
That's right.
And you may also know his name because he's been a Port of Seattle commissioner and a Republican candidate for governor. We're on Twitter at KOW. Let's talk now about, as I mentioned, this week the Trump administration said it's going to stop protecting people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. This is the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DREAMers. Congress never passed DACA. It's an executive order from President Obama. Unless Congress now makes DACA the law, the Trump administration gives them 6 months to do that, or they will stop giving DREAMers work permits, stop protecting them from deportation. President Trump did not make the announcement himself, Professor Parker. His attorney general did. Trump spent the rest of the week seeming ambivalent, saying DREAMers have nothing to worry about, and he loves them, and he might change his mind. You say Trump is blowing smoke. What do you mean? What do you think is going on here?
He is blowing smoke. I could say where he's blowing it, but, you know, this is a family program.
Okay. Let's just say the smoke is drifting.
So, yeah. I mean, so first of all, that he ran a little elf out there to make this announcement is just... That just shows, you know, what kind of disregard, you know, he has from people who benefit from DACA. I mean, think about the past that Sessions has, right? Especially, from the racism all the way to, you know, where we are right now. So I think Trump is what he's doing is he's trying to throw red meat, if you will, no pun intended, to his base. But let me just say this. I think it was a shrewd political move on his part because he throws it right back into the lap of Congress. The issue is, does he even really think, I don't think he even really believes this is going to pass. Because think about where we were the last time with anything that we're related to at, you know, as far as legislative action is concerned. Senate Bill 744, otherwise known as the Comprehensive Immigration Reform back in 2013. That breezed through the Senate. I think it was 68-32. But right now, I mean, getting through the House back then, no way. It didn't get through the House back then. And Congress at the House level has even become more polarized since then. Right. So I don't think this.
So you say it doesn't pass Congress in 6 months.
It does not. I know for sure it doesn't pass the House.
Sentiments might be changing, though, because we've seen Congress members who took a certain position years ago now take a softer approach to DACA recipients. And in talking to a lot of DREAMers themselves, they acknowledge that this program was a temporary Band-Aid, if you will. They've wanted a longer-term solution for a long time, and they wanted that when Democrats controlled both chambers. Mm-hmm. So they're really looking at this. Maybe they think that there's political will now to really make a case for more comprehensive immigration reform.
I don't see it. I think so. The bill last time, Senate Bill 744, that was a really conservative bill. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it breezed through the Senate so easily. But it did not pass the House, and it did not pass the. I mean, think about who came out for comprehensive immigration reform back then. Both of the Bushes came out. Well, all three Bushes came out for it in favor of it. The Wall Street Journal came out in favor of it. Grover Norquist came out in favor of it. Right. So, I mean, you have all these all stars of the right that come out for it and still it can't get through the House. What does that tell you? That tells you that these people, the Freedom Caucus, if you will, that are running the House for the most part. I mean, there are some people that are independent, Paul Ryan, a few people like that. But as long as you got people like Steve King and Louie Gohmert running around, you know, that are coming out against this and stoking up this resentment and fear, it is never going to get through the House. And the House is more polarized now than it was then. Right. So, like I said, it might get through the Senate, but the House is not going to happen. And I hear what Natalie's saying, that, yeah, this was a temporary solution. Right. Mm-hmm. And they wanted something more enduring, which is necessary. Right.
But because there was not a pathway to legal citizenship in the DACA program.
No, it certainly wasn't. But what I'm saying is, if comprehensive immigration reform is any indication of where DACA is going to go, and I just don't think this is going to happen, because that was an extremely conservative bill in a less polarized Congress.
So I guess then the question becomes, does something like the Bridge Act, which is not ideal in the eyes of the Immigration Rights Act advocates that we've been talking to, because it's, again, more of a Band-Aid. It would make DACA law for 3 years. But then the question becomes, who controls Congress and what's going on at that time when it comes up again?
Right. And I think given the current state of Congress right now, if we look at, you know, what's going to happen, let's just look at the Senate side. So right now, Democrats have to defend 23 seats. Republicans have to defend 9 seats. Now, there are 4 of those seats on the Democrat side which are really, really questionable. And they are in states that Trump carried this last election cycle. There are only 2 seats, you know, that are questionable right now. Jeff Flake's seat in Arizona and Dean Heller's seat in Nevada, right? Those are the ones that are possibly in some trouble. But it looks like that Republicans are going to continue to pick up seats, right? And so I think that I just, you know, call me a pessimist, if you will, but, you know, if Senate Bill 744 is any indication, DACA's not going to get through. There's been a long-term plan that's been needed for a very long time. You know, Bush tried to get it done. You know, W tried to get it done a while back. Didn't happen. Obama tried to get it done. Didn't happen. I agree that something needs to be done. I'm just not sure what at this point in time, given how conservative comprehensive immigration reform has already been, and it didn't get through.
Several states, including ours, responded by suing the Trump administration. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson says the president, among other things, is depriving people of due process because of their race.
The president has made numerous statements on the campaign trail and in office disparaging Mexicans, calling them criminals, thugs, bad hombres, among other names. Nearly 80% of Dreamers are of Mexican descent. In our lawsuit, we allege the president's own statements make clear that a majority of Dreamers are being targeted for discriminatory treatment based on their national origin. And I would just ask you and the folks who are listening or viewing this right now to ask yourself one question. If the overwhelming majority of Dreamers were Caucasian, does anybody really think this president would have taken the action he took yesterday?
Well, maybe, maybe not. When President Obama was in office, he warned us against playing the race card here.
I think it's important for those who support, as I do, immigration reform and pathways to citizenship for folks who are here, not to assume that everybody who has trouble with the current immigration system is automatically racist. That's an example of us being able to listen.
Who thinks this is or is not really about race and not just law and order and being a nation of borders?
Well, we can look to the timing of...
So Chris is having trouble holding it in.
If we ask to start to launch this new conversation, why the timing of this announcement this week? It was in response to this lawsuit, the threat, legal action threatened by
Texas.
9 red AGs. Right, who were saying that the DACA program itself raised constitutional questions.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have blue AGs saying something different. So I don't know. To me, it's just this interesting tension.
Well, they're arguing different things. You have the red AGs saying that the president, President Obama, had no authority to issue an executive order regarding immigration when there's standing congressional statute on immigration and only Congress has authority over immigration policy. Then you have Mr. Ferguson and some other blue AGs arguing that this is actually a racial act. They're arguing different things.
And
one's making a very legal argument on whether President Obama ever had the authority to do that at all.
Right.
And that's an important legal question to resolve. I don't think Well, I know I wouldn't. I don't want to say any of us, but I'm very concerned whenever we agree to an environment where the president can say, well, I've wanted this policy and Congress will not pass a law in support of what I want, so I'm just going to do it anyway. That's not consistent with our Constitution.
I want to get back to the original point here. And the original point, Ferguson said, that it was basically a racial thing, that Obama saying, you know, maybe it's not, it shouldn't be about race. Well, look, Obama was president at the time when he said this. He is a black man, the first black person, the first non-white man in the White House. What do we think he's going to say, right, if he wants to curry any kind of favor and support for some of the people that might be on the fence, right? So that he said that, I am not surprised at all, right? Now, I happen to agree with what Ferguson said. Can we, once again, think about this. If we're talking about people coming from Canada, are we really saying that we're not, are we really saying that this is going to be a problem? Let's be for real and let's get out of the Twilight Zone just for a second. I mean, it's just hard for me to fathom that anybody would think otherwise. It's beyond me. And think about it like this. Think about, you have the first black president who wants to say it's not about race, right? But you have a white guy, Ferguson, who says, yeah, it probably is about race. Well, he has the latitude with which to say such things. Obama did not have the same latitude.
What I don't want to see is having us devolve into a discussion over these lawsuits. That's not where the focus should be. The focus should be on Congress.
What do you think Congress is going to do?
We need to fix this. We have kids who have grown up in this country, and it is not consistent with our values to criminalize kids for the behavior of their parents. When they talk about sending them home, there is no other home.
Yeah. Right.
This is their home. Yeah. So Congress needs to step up and fix it so these kids have a status, and they should not wait. Congress should not wait until 5 hours before the six-month deadline expires. These kids need certainty in their lives. They're in school. Mm-hmm. They are working at companies. They own small businesses. And they need to know now that they're going to be protected and be able to stay in their home. And Congress has got to get its act together. I know you say you don't think the House will pass it. I'm not smart enough to predict what this Congress will and will not do. I mean, it's a totally different environment. But I agree with Natalie. Sentiments are changing. People are not prepared to send these kids
anywhere.
Well, and
you have the voice of 800,000 DACA recipients and their families and friends, supporters.
And so I don't know that because again, I don't know what's going to happen in this Congress, but I think it'd be incredibly unlikely that you're going to get comprehensive immigration reform in the next 6 months. I mean, that the list of things they've got to deal with continues to pile up. But I do think that we have sentiments changing enough in Congress that if some leaders step forward, we could put together a statute which would allow this program to continue.
I know you disagree, Professor. We got to pause it there. We have Bill Bryan is one of many Republicans of note saying that it is time to protect the DACA arrivals. 6 months is what President Trump said before he said, "Well, maybe I'll change my mind in 6 months." But we'll see what Congress does. We'll see what President Trump really wants. We are talking with Bill Bryant and Christopher Parker and Natalie Brand. We've got more of the Week in Review coming up.
KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It's 12:45, overcast and 70 degrees in Seattle. Slight chance of showers in the forecast this afternoon and tomorrow and Sunday morning, but then we're expecting mostly sunny skies Sunday afternoon, Monday, and Tuesday.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting jazz pop musician Donald Fagen, formerly of Steely Dan, and his band The Night Flyers, live at the Paramount on September 13th. Tickets at stgpresents.org.
KUOW's Week in Review continuing. A Seattle Seahawk who's been sitting during the national anthem to call attention to racial inequity and police mistreatment of minorities says he was violently profiled and assaulted by a cop 2 weeks ago. Michael Bennett says he was on his way to his Las Vegas hotel when he heard what he thought were gunshots. He and a lot of other people ran for safety, but an officer singled him out, ordered him to the ground, put a gun to his head, told him, "I'll blow your bleeping head off." There is no gun visible in the short video that TMZ released of Bennett on the ground being handcuffed.
"I wasn't doing nothing, man. You didn't ask me a question. I was here with my friends. They told us to get out. Everybody ran. Can you ask me a question, sir?"
I was with my friends. They told us to get out. Everybody ran. Bennett says Las Vegas police officers singled me out and pointed their guns at me for doing nothing more than simply being a black man in the wrong place at the wrong time. But the Las Vegas Police Department says Michael Bennett acted in a way that created a reasonable suspicion. The officers, who the police department pointed out are Latino, were told that an active shooter was firing in a crowded casino. When they got there, Bennett was hiding behind a slot machine. When officers turned toward him, he, quote, bolted out of the casino, leaped over a 4-foot barrier wall, and hid from officers as he crouched close to the wall on the sidewalk. Las Vegas police are calling Bennett's claims wrong and defamatory, and asking the NFL to investigate Bennett's, quote, obvious false allegations. What stands out to you about this?
So, first of all, we don't know exactly what happened.
Yeah.
These are contested claims, contested reports right now. So until more of the facts come out that will allow folks, you know, at the relevant agencies to adjudicate this, this is something on which I am not willing to speak, right? I'd like to speak on the issue for which he is most well known for, the sitting during the national anthem and the sort of and the treatment of Colin Kaepernick and how people have interpreted this. So for people to say this is disrespectful to veterans, well, I'm a veteran. I don't find it disrespectful. For people to say that it's unpatriotic, let's think about this. This country was founded on dissent. All right, let's just take a pause. Let's press pause and give a quick history lesson. The Patriots, they were the ones that fought against the British, right? And their loyalists, right? American patriotism is founded on dissent, tolerance, equality, right? These other founding values that lay at the core of this country, and freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And so, for these people to say it is unpatriotic for anyone to protest, that, and even in this manner, it just does violence to what this country's supposed to be about. And so, to the extent that this country was founded on dissent, and these folks are practicing dissent through peaceful protests, right? How is this a bad thing? Especially when the forces against whom they're speaking are not acting consistent with the countries on which this country was, excuse me, the values on which this country was founded. So these people need to look up. They need to take a history class or something. They want to come and sit on one of my classes. I am happy to accommodate them. But for them to say this is unpatriotic, for these men to do this, you know, I think it's just wrong.
Anyone disagree? I think a lot of the attitude is, yeah, but I just want to watch a football game, and I don't want to be political, and I don't want this. I don't want the Seahawks divided, and it's a moment for unity before we play this game. That's the argument, right?
But there's been a lot of pain that's been dredged up over the past few weeks, and this is a conversation that we need to have about racial tensions. And I would ask Professor Parker, what positives do you see coming out of? I mean, there's been a lot of shocking headlines, a lot of pain, as I said. So, what are you looking forward to in, I guess, coming weeks and years and trying to address some of this?
Well, I guess people, more and more people are talking about the continuing racial inequality that we have in this country. And I think that's what Kaepernick wanted to do, is to start at least having a conversation to interrogate the practices, because the practices that we have, and there's a difference between, you know, values and beliefs and the actual social practices. There's been a gap in this for a very long time. Back during World War II, this very famous Swedish economist, Gunnar Myrdal, wrote a book called An American Dilemma. And what he's talking about is dilemma of having these progressive beliefs, if you will, in America that's supposed to be part of the American creed, and how inconsistent it is or was with American social practices. I can't even say we've made a whole lot of progress given, look at what's happening with all the black people that have been getting shot and murdered by the police. Look at what happened in South Carolina at Mother Emanuel. This guy, Dylan Roof, kills 9 black people and he gets treated to Burger King. Are you kidding me? Right. So this is a conversation we sorely need to have in 2017. And so that's, you know, ultimately, I would like to have more racial justice, but we have to have waypoints in between that here and there. And one place to start is to have a critical conversation about these things.
How much of a statement is it when one or two Seahawks sit during the anthem? Maybe one player puts his hand on the shoulder of somebody who's sitting, but it's not most of the team coming together and saying this is worth a statement. It's almost a statement in the negative. You can look at it like that when you see how few people are with him visually.
No, I agree to the degree, and that's an issue, you know, for me. I mean, you have all these black players on the Seahawks and you only have one or two who actually does this. I don't even understand that, right? And when you consider the NFL as a league is, 70-75% black, and there's only a handful of players that are actually doing this. I mean, I think part of it has to do with the structure of NFL contracts. I mean, it's so easy to cut NFL players, right? NFL contracts are not guaranteed. The NBA, they're guaranteed. The Major League Baseball, they're guaranteed, right? NFL, they're not the same. So I think that might have something to do with it, the sort of economic incentive that are around this. And let's just call it what it is. Football is the most conservative major professional sport that we have, right?
And why conservative?
You know what? I don't know. I was racking my brain about that earlier. I really don't know.
What makes you think it's conservative?
Well, maybe it's the closest some of these sports come to war, right? Maybe. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there right now.
All right. Well, as you say, I think you're right to say that there's a lot we don't know. And there's certainly, if there are video cameras anywhere, they're in two places. Number one, on police uniforms. Oh, sorry, those weren't turned on in Las Vegas. Body cameras not turned on. Number two, everywhere else in Las Vegas. Every casino, inside, outside, it is Camera City. So maybe we'll learn more.
There's an attorney involved.
There's an attorney involved. Michael Bennett has...
retained a civil rights attorney out of California.
Yes, and they're... He's exploring his options. No lawsuit yet, but with a lot more to come on that. And by the way, the national media, you're going to be hearing a lot about what happens this Sunday in Green Bay when the Seahawks, when that national anthem comes up and the flag billows and the red rockets glare. We'll see what Michael Bennett does, and so will everybody else. One more thing I want to talk about on the Week in Review. You mentioned Bill Bryant, that you should be. Why are you here? You could be on a bike ride instead of being on a weekend.
I could be on
review.
A bike ride, right?
I think it turned out quite well for you, honestly.
Oh, yeah, this is fun. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, I'm glad.
Better than the bike ride?
No, not better than the bike ride.
No. It was another smoky week that canceled your bike trip. Are those clouds now or ash? I guess I'm not sure anymore. I know there's a little wind kicked up, but anyway, after a fairly calm summer, considering how dry it's been, now we've got some big wildfires going in Washington State, in Oregon. Big one near the Canadian border, one at the Oregon border that was at least partly started by fireworks, it sounds like. A woman who was hiking in the Columbia River Gorge says she saw a teenager throw a smoke bomb into the canyon. Then she saw smoke billowing. She said, quote, "I told him, do you realize you just started a forest fire?" And the kid who had been filming with his cell phone said, "What are we supposed to do about it now?" And I said, "Call the freaking fire department," end of quote. She told Oregon Public Broadcasting these kids seemed to be completely indifferent.
All of those kids that he was with are complicit. All of them watched. All of them did nothing. One filmed it. I'm pretty sure I heard a couple of them giggle.
Giggle. Now, as someone who set a field on fire with fireworks when he was a teenager, that would be me. That look of indifference, that's sometimes how a teenager panics. We're playing it cool, or the closest we can get. In fact, what happened is, do you want to know the story?
Yeah, I want to hear the story.
So Steve Happel and I are in suburban Omaha and walking along with, you know what punks are? The things you use to light firecrackers, and if you rubber band a bunch of punks together and they're all glowing red, you can blow across them and get a flame going. So Steve, not me, I will say, Steve Happel, I'll give out his address in a moment. he set some dry July grass on fire, And then I said, okay, put it out, put it out. And he says, no, wait a minute, it'll get a little bigger. And then he says, and then he starts to put it out, and now I'm interested. Nah, come on, let it get a little bit bigger. And then it's his turn. And then he waves his takes his jacket off and waves his jacket at it, and the whole field's on fire. And everyone's fine, as it turned out. But it was just a little, a little abandoned sort of lot. But on the way, as we're running out of there to a home, to the nearest home to get him to call the fire department, Steve is telling me, it wasn't us. You don't know anything. We don't. He was going over this mantra like he was already on the way that you convince yourself. He said, you're just we don't know anything about this. So he could play it cool. And we got to the house and said, call the cops. And the person did. And I rode away on my bicycle. I could hear the sound of fire department, and everyone was safe. It was a lot of dry grass. My point is,
this is serious.
Yeah, it was serious. It was very serious. Yeah. I'm not, Bill, you've been evacuated by a fire before.
I was, and
this is a little more personal to you. This was not a teenage incident.
My bike trip was canceled, but there's a lot of folks who are having their homes and livelihoods threatened right now and have already lost homes and livelihoods, and it's very serious. Yeah, in 2015, I got a call and had about 2 or 3 hours to pull stuff together and get out of Winthrop, and a lot of our neighbors did, and the year before, a lot of folks in the community lost their homes, and it's very tragic. And we've got to figure out a new forest management policy so that we don't see this happening year after year.
Doesn't that mean money for clearing out
it
brush?
It does. We've for too long just simply locked up too much land and not managed it in a way that would help prevent fire. And then when we have had fire on some of these lands, we've quickly suppressed it. Mm-hmm. And so for over decades, we have built a tinderbox out there, and one lightning strike can ignite that tinderbox, and that's what we're seeing happen over and over again. In this particular case down in Oregon, yes, it's fireworks, but most often it's lightning,
right,
something like that. And we need to go into these areas that have not been logged or are not being grazed and clear out that underbrush, and we need to go in and thin out a lot of dead and other trees. There's a lot of opposition to that.
Do your Republican colleagues agree with you?
I think the Republican colleagues do, and even some of my friends in the environmental community who might not be Republicans are beginning to realize that the decades of fire suppression and simply locking up land has led to or contributed to a situation where we have explosive fires on an annual basis.
I'm just struck that we're dealing with these wildfires, and on the other side of the country, there's Hurricane Irma that we're glued to coverage, and, it's one natural disaster after another.
Southern Idaho's had 130 earthquakes since Saturday. I mean, that's an amazing statistic in and of itself.
May I ask the Republican a question real quick? You believe in climate change?
Yes.
Thank you. All right.
And I believe that humans contribute to climate change. I do not, though, however, as the governor said, attribute all of these fires to climate change. We've had fires on the West long before the planet began to heat up in the industrial period post-World War II. We had some significant fires at the beginning of the century, which actually led to Forest Service practice of putting out fires as quickly as they started. Okay. And now we're living with the legacy of decades of fire suppression, when in some cases we need to let it burn. We've understood that. And in some areas now where homes and businesses are not being threatened, the fires are allowed to burn. But just simply allowing them to burn is not a long-term policy. We need to go in and actively manage these forests in a more appropriate way.
Well, we hope this week doesn't get worse for the people in the Okanagan and the people along the Gorge and all across the Northwest, and obviously in the American Southeast as this hurricane heads toward, Puerto Rico and Florida. And we'll keep watching it. You've got colleagues down there in Florida, right, Natalie?
Yes. My colleague Allison Morrow is currently in Florida, so stay safe, Allison, and Ryan Coe, her photographer. And then we also, our sister station in Houston was actually flooded. So mm-hmm. we've been sending resources to Texas as well, and we're in position to help any of our sister stations across the country, Florida and the Southeast, because, this is a time when everyone needs to pull together.
That's King 5 political reporter Natalie Brand. Also with us this hour, University of Washington political science professor Christopher Parker, and founder and chair of Bryant Christie, Inc., and former Port of Seattle Commissioner, Republican Bill Bryant. It's good to see all of you. Thanks for coming in on the Weekend Review.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good time.
We're on Twitter @KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Hey.